Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
The Reserve Bank's decision this month to cut the official cash rate to a record low 1.25%, and indeed, almost everyone thinks that there'll be more cuts, probably to, by the end of the year, a cash rate of 0.75%, has lifted the hopes of many would-be home buyers in search of a better mortgage deal. But all is not rosy in the property market. The optimism felt by people looking for home loans has coincided with a collapse in the number of houses and flats being built, and that's not good news for builders or tradies trying to earn a living. The bad news doesn't stop there. The effects from the downturn in residential construction are also filtering through to Australia's long-suffering retail sector. When was the last time we had any good news about how things were going in the retail sector? Years and years is the answer. Anyway, here to explain how the pain in the property market weaves its way through other parts of the economy and to talk about the investment scene generally, of course, is Roger Montgomery, Chief Investment Officer with the Montgomery Fund. Rog, good evening and welcome back to Nightlife.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Phil.
And likewise, great to have you with
us. It's a highlight of my week, I have to say. I look forward to coming on because yeah. I can chat for a while.
Exactly, we've got some time. I was talking to an economist today saying it is such an interesting time at the moment. I mean, for all sorts of reasons, not some of which are not good.
Look, there's a lot going on. On the one hand, there's the economy. Mm. And then on the other hand, you've got, you know, weird things happening in various asset prices or asset classes with their prices. And there seems to be a bit of a disconnect going on. The share market seems to be doing very well, but then the underlying fundamentals of many of the businesses aren't going well. And those shares that are doing the best, some of them don't even make a profit. So we're going to talk about all of that. We're going to talk about what's happening in the domestic economy with respect to housing and its impact on retail. But also, you know, we're going to chat about some of these, you know, the really what I call the pointy end of a very expensive market, the what are known as the wax stocks.
Yeah, so, let's talk about those because that's right.
Okay,
because,
you want to do that first?
Let's get to those. Let's talk about property first because as you say, there are many, many gloomy, there are many, many warning signs out there, but still the market rages on and no one seems to know when it's about to stop, although certainly it will at some point.
Let's set the scene. The three biggest employers in the country are number one, healthcare, number two, retail, and number three, construction. Construction employs 9.6% of the Australian workforce, and residential construction, which is a small part of that, employs about a third of that, so 37%. So it's about 3.5% of the Australian workforce is employed directly in residential construction. Okay, so it's important what happens in that sector. Now, what we know from earlier in the year, right at the start of the year, what we saw was a very big collapse in domestic residential housing approvals, both in freestanding homes and also multi-storey residences, so apartments. So the net effect or the combined drop in residential approvals is about 40%. Mm-hmm. So what's happened, it's gone from about 280,000 dwellings per year to about 170,000 dwellings a year. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that if you think about it this way, you can't build anything unless you go and get council approval. Mm-hmm. So if you've had a 40% drop or near 40% drop in approvals, then that means down the track there's going to be a big drop in construction activity because less people are seeking approval to build anything.
Yep.
And so when we knew these aggregate stats were happening. So what I did is I went and spoke to a couple of CEOs of house and land package developers, for example, spoke to people at, you know, companies like, and I won't name the precise companies we spoke to because some of them aren't listed, but companies like the Villa Worlds and the Metricons and the AV Jennings of the world. Mm-hmm. And what these people who I spoke to told me, and one of them is one of the biggest in New South Wales, he said that if something dramatic doesn't happen, and he was alluding to an RBA rate cut and changes to APRA's limits on, or their upper limit on the sort of the risk-weighted mortgage rate, the stressed mortgage rate, mm-hmm. which was at 7%, If something doesn't happen, he said to me, we're going to see our pipeline is already down 50%, so we're going to have to let people go. Now, if you think about the consequences of that, that's 50% drop in activity, and if you spread that out nationwide, affecting 3.5% of the workforce.
Over what period is he talking about?
Between now and Christmas.
Okay.
Or they were, there's a few of them that were reflecting the similar sort of numbers. So you've got 3.5% of the workforce that's staring down the barrel of half the level of building activity. So that obviously would panic the RBA. So I'm not surprised that they cut recently, and I expect that they will cut again and maybe again.
That's the feeling, isn't it? That by the end of the year, it might get to 0.75?
Well, yeah, two more cuts is, you know, earlier in the year, I thought we would have a 50 or 75 basis point cut in one go. I'm not sure why we're doing it little by little, because we can see this cliff coming. We've spoken to people on the ground. We know that they're going to let people go. Now, the reason why it's serious is not only does it affect immediately the construction workers, so they're either going to be unemployed or underemployed. Underemployed meaning they're not going to be earning as much money. Remember, a lot of them are contractors and they're tradies and they're working for themselves.
Sure.
And so they're not going to have as much work on. Classic example of that. One of the developers told me that last year they could get a brickies for a, you know, brick. They couldn't get a brickie, and they were laying bricks for about $1.80 a brick, and now they can get, they've got brickies coming out of their ears and happy to lay for $1.30, $1.40 a brick. Mm-hmm. So we know that this is actually happening. And what it means is if they're working less and earning less money, they've got less money to spend at the shops. So there's a couple of consequences, or second order consequences. The number one thing is that they've all got mortgages as well. They're going to have to focus on those mortgages, and so they're going to be spending less at the shops. And so we saw, for example, some numbers come out today or earlier in the week, rather, from on car sales in Australia.
Yeah, well, they've been gloomy for a while.
Yeah, and they've been going down for a while. And you might remember earlier in the year I mentioned to you that I spoke to a friend of mine who runs a couple of dealerships, Mercedes dealerships in New South Wales, and he was saying that sales nationally for Mercedes-Benz were down about 40%. Now across all the brands and across all the vehicles, what we know is that they've declined substantially, and we've now seen the biggest decline, about 7%, and it's the biggest decline in about 9 years in car sales. So when people feel what's called the negative wealth effect, so they feel like they're less wealthy than they were, their property prices going down, they've still got a large mortgage, they need to pay that off, the first thing that's going to be deferred are what we call big ticket items. So people aren't going to spend as much money on holidays, they're not going to spend as much money on cars, they're not going to go out. And obviously, because they're buying less houses or developing less houses, people simply aren't applying for approvals to build homes, or they're not applying to the Metricons and the AV Jennings of the world to go and build homes. Guess what? They're not going to need as much Manchester. They're not going to need homewares. They're not going to need as many beds and as many furniture.
Well, Harveys and JB and places like that would be concerned.
Yeah, and so indeed they would. And we saw just the other day, we saw Adairs. Adairs are the sort of homewares and Manchester chain of stores. Mm-hmm. Now, between the start of April and the end of May, their share price was up about 30%. And then they came out and they reduced their guidance for the financial year 2019. They reduced their guidance from about a $48 million mid-range to about a $43 million mid-range. It's only about a 10% decline or thereabouts. The share price came off about 22% or 23%. So, you know, this is just starting. And I think between now and Christmas, it's going to get a lot worse unless, miraculously, the RBA's cuts stimulate people to want to go out and buy and build property again.
Well, that's the purpose of them, isn't it? I mean, the reason they are cutting rates is because they want to stimulate the economy.
It is a blunt instrument, and you've got to remember that.
Will the banks pass it on, do you think?
Well, I think as each cut is made, less of the cut can be passed on.
Why?
Because what happens is the net interest margin, the spread, because remember, as interest rates come down, they're still competing, the banks are still competing for deposits, so they can't drop interest rates on deposits as much because that's their cheapest source of funding. And if they drop rates on mortgages by the full amount that the bank, the RBA, you know, implies that they should, then their net interest margin collapses. They don't make as much money. And so they're less likely to pass as much of it on. They want to preserve some of their profitability.
You're saying if, okay, it's 1.25 at the moment. If it went to 1.75, in other words, if there were two drops of 0.25 by the end of the year, you're saying that...
Well, the one we just had, all of it wasn't passed.
Except by two banks.
Yeah.
That's true, but the other banks did.
Yes, they did. And I think as we go further down the rate, you'll find that less is able to be passed on. There's more compression in the net interest margin if they keep doing that. Mm. And so it's a blunt instrument. It needs to be combined with other what we call macroprudential measures. So after the David Murray Financial System Inquiry back in 2014 or 2015, and after the Royal Commission, the banks really tighten the screws on credit availability. That needs to loosen. It doesn't matter if your mortgage rate is 3.4% or 2.4%. If the banks aren't qualifying you for a loan, you can't get the money.
Yeah, a lot of people say, I'd like your view on this, a lot of people are saying, well, look, you know, the Reserve Bank can do what it can, but as you say, it's a relatively blunt instrument, interest rates, and also they really don't have much of a lever to work anymore because it's a very short lever. They've got almost no room to cut at all. That what's needed now, and very decisively, is for the government, which is the other big player, to step in here and say, look, forget all this surplus business, which we is a luxury we cannot afford right now, and we're going to have to spend.
Yeah, so you can use fiscal policy to
spend. We're going to have to spend big.
Tax cuts.
Spend big. Either spend big on infrastructure projects or tax cuts or do something.
Well, in your introduction to the program tonight, you talked about tax cuts and that's what we're trying to, that's what the government, not we, but that's, as Australians, that's what we need to see. So I really believe that macroprudential measures, fiscal policy and monetary policy need to all to be used in combination for people to start, I guess, for the animal spirits to be stirred again so that people will go out and invest in property. Because who really needs to be rescued in all of this is really the construction industry for the reasons I've just explained. Mm.
The wage issue is, I mean, this issue of low wages, which is one of the reasons the retail sector is so poor, I mean, is because no one's got money to buy things for a start. And without wage growth, that's going to continue.
Well, they've also borrowed to the hilt to speculate on property.
Correct. And you know, household debt's at record levels.
Indeed. And that takes a while to erode. You know, it takes a while to eat into that. So we're not going to see, whatever happens, Phil, we're not going to see a V-shaped bottom in residential property prices in Australia. I think we'll see a bottom at some point in the next 6 months. Mm. I think we're very close to it.
But
I think it grinds slowly higher.
Some bumping along the bottom.
Yeah, indeed. I don't think we're going to get this big, sharp V-shaped bottom, which is great for buyers because it means you can take your time. But it also means there's fewer good quality properties coming on the market because the vendors who don't need to sell will hold off selling. They'll just keep, they'll stay where they are. And so there's no forced selling going on because rates are cheaper, people can afford it, they're getting tax cuts. And so that's why I think in the net result is a sort of a bumping along the bottom for property prices. So people who are looking for a good quality property may find they still need to work pretty hard to snap one up if it comes on the market. There's not going to be a lot of forced selling. But the flip side is you can take your time.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, but in the meantime, as you say, beware of companies in the retail business.
Well, it depends on what side of the fence you're on. If you don't own them already, then I think the next 6 to 12 months is going to present a lot of great opportunities.
Oh, I see.
So, you know, the ups, you want to buy stocks like you buy groceries. You know, I know in the winter I don't buy blueberries. You know, they're $9 a punnet or $7 a punnet. You know, there's no way I'm buying blueberries. My kids don't appreciate them. If, however, come summer, they're $2 a punnet, you know, I'm going to buy five of them. Mm. You know, I'm going to spend $10 for five punnets of blueberries. No problem. And you buy the stocks the same way. When they're cheap, you know, and you know that they're at a cyclical low because eventually the economy will recover. Eventually some of these businesses will do well. And if you buy them after a downgrade when everyone thinks they're going to go out of business or there's a recession looming, well, that's precisely the time you want to buy them, when everything looks doom and gloom and it looks like there's no possibility that they're ever going to recover. That's when people are dumping them at ridiculous prices.
What do you think, though, is going to get us out of this? Because it's not entirely clear. Well, I mean, you sound sceptical, and so do a lot of other experts.
Well, you need a deleveraging.
A lot of experts say, look, this interest rate cut's not going to get us out of it.
You need a deleveraging. So deleveraging is a period where credit growth, so the rate at which people are borrowing money or expanding their level of borrowing, either on credit cards or whatever, is that credit growth is slower than economic growth. Mm-hmm. They're deleveraging. So they're reducing the amount of debt compared to the economy. And that slows things down. And if interest rates are already at really, really cheap prices, people aren't, you know, it doesn't matter if it, as I said, it doesn't matter if it's 3.5, 3.4 or 2.4. Mm. People aren't going to go, oh, gee, it's cheap now. It was cheap last year. So I think the debt has to come down so that people feel confident again that they can borrow again. They also need to believe that property prices have bottomed. If they think that property prices are going to keep going down, they're going to be reluctant to speculate on property.
Well, they have bottomed in some parts of the market anyway. As we know, they've been at the bottom for a long period of
time. Look, I think Sydney,
you know, Western Australia, Sydney, for example, is, in Perth, it's been down for a long time period of time. Adelaide's, you know, been down for a long period of time.
I think we're close to the bottom, generally.
In Sydney and Melbourne, which are the two hot markets that people are obsessed by.
We're close.
To the bottom.
We're pretty close. Mind you, I would be, for example, I said to you last year, I said at some point in the next 18 months or 24 months, it'll be a really good time to invest in an apartment because there'll be some forced selling going on. You know, the difficulty or the complication that now exists is the quality of the build of some of these apartment blocks. Mm. You know, and it's very hard to know who's built a high quality apartment. Now, I think there are some brands out there that have been around for a very long time. Some of them have made their own as billionaires, and we know who they are. Now, they don't have problems with quality. So you need to be discerning about which apartments you're going to buy because the quality issue could be a big one.
Hmm. Talking about the property market, also wanted to have a chat, Roger, about the tech sector as well.
Wow!
Now, I mean, many people say this is a classic bubble at the moment.
Yeah, look, I've written articles in the Oz about this and on our blog, and I have to say I've seen this before. Mm. So I was working many, many years ago, back in 1999. I was working at Merrill Lynch when Merrill Lynch had a big retail stockbroking presence in Australia. And I can remember, and I worked as a stockbroker for 12 months, and I can remember just the optimism for companies that were going to somehow turn their eyeballs on their websites into revenue. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading a report, and I wish I had it with me. I do have it in the attic at home. There was a book that came out, and one of the lines in the book caught my attention at the time, and it said, The ability of these companies to change the world forever means you can almost pay any price for them. And that's what was happening. People were paying any price for these things. Now, there's a difference between that bubble and what we're seeing today, but it's only subtle. Back then, the hope was that companies would be able to work out how to generate revenue. So many of the companies that did really well, Phil, and I don't know if you remember this, but they were mining companies that just decided to change their name to .com. You know, something.com. There was actually a company that I wrote about in my book called NetJ.com. NetJ.com in their prospectus, when they listed on the NASDAQ in the US in 1999, it was about November, I think, 1999. They said in their prospectus, and I remember it this well that I can quote from the prospectus. They actually said NetJ.com conducts no substantial business activity of any description, and NetJ.com has no plans of conducting any substantial business activity of any description for
money.
The foreseeable future. The listing was, I think, around 50 cents. Hmm. No, it was around, it was around $2 a share. No, sorry, correct that. It was 50 cents. They listed at $2. And then they went to $8.88 before they collapsed. Mm. And they never, true to label, they never conducted any business activity of any description. Now, the hope then, there was hope around that. The hope at the time was they would do something with the money that they got were given during the capital raising. The hope was they'd find a way to make revenue in the internet space. Today, many of these companies are making revenue. And in Australia, we have a group of companies called the WAX stocks, WAAX. So it's WiseTech, Appen, Afterpay, Altium, and Xero.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about the WAX stocks in just a minute. But the hope is now not that they'll work out how to generate revenue, but they'll somehow work out how to turn their revenue into profits. And in the case of Xero, which is the popular software accounting software company based in New Zealand, they are generating revenue, but not profit, or they've just become cash flow break even at the moment. They're forecast to generate about $23 million or $28 million profit in 2021, but they're trading at a market capitalization of about $8.5 billion, and they're only going to make $23 million or $28 million. So they're trading on something like 370 times their forecast 2021 earnings. And then you've got a company like WiseTech, which, by the way, we think at Montgomery, it's actually a very high-quality business. They're a logistics software company. They basically have 75% of one market and 100% of the other market. They're a market cap of about $8.5 billion. But to put that in perspective, Qantas is on a market cap of $8.5 billion, and Qantas's revenue is about $16 billion. WiseTech's revenue is about $355 million.
Mm.
So, you know, they're very, very expensive, and there's a lot of optimism priced into these companies. And as I said, I've seen this before. You always get a concentration of money around a theme at the top of the market. And this time it's these WAX stocks. And, you know, and we saw it towards the end of last year, and then the market corrected, and market corrected about 15% or thereabouts. Some of these stocks fell by about 50% and they've gone on to new highs. And I think we're at the same point we were just before that minor correction in October to December last year.
Okay, look, let's take some calls. Tony, hello.
Hey, how you going, Phil? And sorry,
Roger. Yep.
Roger. G'day, Tony.
How are you, mate? Listen, I'm just changing. We're getting solar panels put on the house.
Yeah.
Right? And the guy, you know, when we went through all the stuff and the paperwork and that, and he goes, "Oh, you know, like obviously you've got to check your credit, but I don't have a credit card, and I only have a debit card." And he did something on his phone, and then I got a password number, and gave it to him, and he. And he looks at me and he goes, "You got a AAA credit rating." And I'm like, if I've got a AAA credit rating, how bad is everybody else?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so what's interesting is the technology found out your credit rating in a couple of seconds while you're standing there on site. You know, that's amazing technology. What people are getting really excited about is how the technology is going to change the world, and they're paying ridiculous prices for it. And you're absolutely right. At the same time, there's a lot of people out there, you know, who probably haven't lost their jobs. They're still earning good income, and they're still able to pay off.
Have you borrowed a lot of money in your life, Tony?
Do I borrow?
No, have you?
Have
you borrowed a lot of money in your life?
In the younger days, I've got a house. I'm paying a mortgage off, and but, like, I've paid everything off, and I don't owe any money on any cars. And
there you go.
See, that's why you're AAA credit rating.
That's why you're AAA. Because if you've got a mortgage and you're paying it off, right, and you do it regularly and you pay off your credit cards, that's AAA.
That's what we call a good credit history.
Yeah.
See, what we haven't had, Tony, in Australia is a negative, what we call a negative credit experience. We haven't had an event where people find it tougher to pay down their debts or they start missing their payments. That could happen over the next 6 to 12 months when we see a lot of these tradies earning less money. So we'll wait and see how bad it gets.
Mm.
Oh, thank you. I just didn't know whether he was telling me the truth or not.
No, feel good.
About you?
Yeah.
Only you know that.
Feel good about yourself, Tony. Get it on your mate.
Take Thanks. It easy, guys.
Yeah, okay,
you
bye.
You too, bye-bye. Robin. Yeah, g'day, Robin.
Yeah, hello, Roger. Hi, Philip.
Hi, Robin.
I was just trying to work out the wisest thing to do. I'm just sort of inheriting some money.
Mm-hmm.
I've got about 10 years of working life to go. I'm inheriting only like about $200,000.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a choice. I could pay my mortgage off, which would pay all of it and a bit more. I could buy some shares, seeing as you suggested, or I could put it on my super.
Yeah, look, I can't.
Both, maybe some of each.
You know? I can't give you. Look, that's a sort of a fence sitting strategy, you know, a bit of everything. I can't give you any personal advice, but you know what? Paying off the mortgage and not having that debt over your head always gives you some. And if you said you've still got some money left over after you do that, well, that puts you in a really confident and flexible financial position, because you'll have had your mortgage paid off. Interest rates are coming off. If asset prices ever drop precipitously, and if you listen to the program here, we'll always let you know how things are going. Then you can always borrow against your property to invest in something else down the track. Now, I don't know your capacity to pay a larger loan or not, so that's why I can't give you very specific advice. But not having that mortgage definitely gives you options. You know, that's probably a good thing. If you then, if you use the capital to invest in a risky asset, and that asset that doesn't go well, then you've got an asset that you're underwater on and you haven't paid off your mortgage, you know, and that doesn't, then you're not in such a strong financial position.
Mind you,
someone else could give you very different, you know, a very different scenario. I'm just I tend to be more conservative.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
Okay.
Good luck, Robin.
No problem. That's just one person's opinion.
Thanks. Thanks, Robin. Bye-bye. 1-300-800-222. There are some lines free. John, g'day.
G'day. How are you?
Not bad.
G'day, John.
Just on Robin's thing, I'm not a financial advisor either, but what I have done is I have a $500,000 mortgage.
Yep.
But I have a...
Redraw?
An offset account.
Yeah, you've got an offset account and a redraw, yeah.
With $480,000 sitting there.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm only paying interest on the difference.
On the 20 grand.
Yeah, so my interest payments for each month is about $40.
Yeah.
The reason I've done that is so that if, as will come into my question in a minute, I need the money...
Yeah, you've always got that redraw facility.
And I don't have to pay for additional borrowing costs.
Indeed. And so when I talked about paying down, usually, you know, modern variable rate mortgages these days have an offset account. The banks tend to offer that to you anyway, because they tend to believe that you're going to spend that money, and so they'll keep the mortgage going for a long time. But if Robin, actually, you know, pushes that down to a sort of a very minimal amount, she doesn't have anything to pay, and she's got that flexibility, and it's always there, and it's always approved for her.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now,
correct.
That leads into my question of, given the amount of debt that the world has, especially you look at America and possibly Europe. Yep. I mean, in some ways, we're possibly worse than 2007.
We've used debt to pay off debt. That's right. More debt to pay off the debt.
If we come to a recession or even a depression, what's the... in the 1930s, there would have been people who made money hand over fist. I'm just wondering, if we got to that situation again, what are sort of assets and asset classes that kind of give you... sense of recession proof?
Yeah, nothing. Yeah, very little. In that scenario, you know, depression's an extreme example. Look, there are some fringe economists out there who believe that we avoided a depression after the global financial crisis through quantitative easing and fairly unconventional monetary policy around the world by central banks. Negative rates in Europe, for example, ZERP in the United States, which stands for zero interest rate policy. But all it did was kick the can further down the road.
Yeah.
So we didn't get rid of the problem. We didn't let capitalism do its job. Capitalism does well when people's excesses are corrected through a recession and people going broke and businesses going broke. And so that corrects what we call a misallocation of resources. That hasn't happened. All we've done is extended that period where money's been cheap, interest rates have been low, and it's afforded wealthy people to become wealthier through speculation on assets. So there's that view, and I have some sympathy with that view. my view on a recession at the moment is that we're, you know, maybe there's maybe a 20 or 25% chance of a recession, and that's about it. So to put that in perspective, that's a 75 or 80% chance of no recession.
Okay.
So you know, I would be reluctant to be putting a strategy together where you believe there's going to be a recession or a depression. But in answer to your question, in a depression type scenario, there's really nowhere to hide. You know, money in the mattress is probably, you know, cash in the mattress is probably the only thing that's any good. And then you run the risk of being robbed. So it's not that safe.
True.
Righto, yep. John.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, mate. Bye-bye. We're taking calls. Roger Montgomery's our guest tonight from the Montgomery Fund. And we're talking investment and property and all of that, as you know. Ash is probably a similar question to what Robin had earlier. I've just inherited $220,000 with no possibility of borrowing any more.
Mm.
Where do I buy something or put my money in? Appreciate your help. I have no super.
Okay, so that's all they've got. I need a bit more information. I need to know if they've
got
a job.
Offer specific advice.
Yeah, have they got a job? Are they earning income? You know, have they got another source of income?
Mm.
What are their spending habits? You know, there's a lot to know in that. There's nothing out there that I would be willing to say, go and buy this and you'll do really well, because then everybody will be throttling us if it goes badly. So I can't really help on that one.
There are tax advantages in owning your own home and tax advantages in super, aren't there?
Yeah, indeed.
I suppose we could say that.
Don't let tax drive your investment decision, though. I think that's a mistake. Okay. It always comes back to the quality of the asset and the price that you pay for it. You want to buy a very high-quality asset and you want to get as cheap as you possibly can. Wherever that opportunity is, it doesn't really matter if it's property or shares or whatever. Mm. That's what you're after.
Are Australian government or corporate bonds a good investment at the moment?
Well, do you know what? Because interest rate expectations are declining, people think interest rates are going to drop. People are worried that there's going to be a recession. And so further out the yield curve, interest rates are falling. You do very well owning longer duration assets, because when you buy a bond and interest rates drop, the next person who buys that bond is willing to accept a lower rate. And so they pay a higher price for that bond. So you make a capital gain on the credit instrument. And so, yes, it's been a good place to be.
Hi, Julie. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Hi, Julie.
Hi. Look, there used to be a lot of talk in the media, financial media, about the 24-hour investment clock, the correlation between shares and property. When shares are up, property's down, and vice versa. You don't hear much talk about that anymore. So I suppose my first question is, do you believe that relationship still exists?
Has the clock stopped?
And if you have time, Roger's views on Challenger, the share company at the moment. I bought it, did well, took my eye off the ball, gone back down.
Yes.
Worth hanging on or not? Just, you know, you've done your day, so forget it.
Yeah, look, I think it's got some challenges at the moment in a low interest rate environment. Pardon the pun.
Yeah.
And the reason why it's got some challenges is, in a low interest rate environment, you know, the appetite for annuities, which is the product the Challenger sells, is somewhat diminished. The other problem is there is a massive upheaval going on in the financial planning space at the moment. And, you know, I know a lot of financial planners. I'm friends with a lot of financial planners. They're having a tough time at the moment. There's a huge upheaval. Many of them will have to go back to university to get a degree in order to be qualified to be a financial planner. Some of the older financial planners don't want to do that. So they're leaving, they're selling their businesses. So while all that's going on, it's difficult for companies like Challenger and other fund managers to go and sell their products through the financial planning network. So that's a real challenge for Challenger at the moment. But sitting over the top of that is the prospect that they might receive a takeover offer from a Japanese company. You just don't, you know, I can't predict those things. But at the moment, they've got some challenges. I think those challenges are reflected in the share price. So the share price has come off from about, what, it's come off from about $14 to about $7 or thereabouts.
Yep,
so it's, you know, it's sort of halved over the last 19 months or 20 months. So it's pretty much in the share price, but you don't know how much worse it could get. And so there still could be some downside there. Look, I'm not giving you the answer you want. I can't give you...
No, the answer's fine.
Okay.
The answer's perfectly fine.
All I can do is give you some information and you'll have to go and make a decision with that information yourself.
Happy to do that.
Now, what was the other question?
The investment clock.
The 24-hour investment clock.
So back in October, November last year, I would have said we were sort of, you know, a couple of seconds to midnight. and very close to a, you know, a scenario that would lead to much cheaper prices in the stock market. That happened, but it bounced again very quickly, pretty much from Christmas Eve. I still think we're very close to that midnight hour. And I just can't tell you, you know, whether it's 1 minute or 5 minutes, but I think we're pretty close to it. I don't see conditions for the economy improving dramatically, and I see asset prices very, very high. What's basically happened is that the fundamentals usually should be the motivation for owning an asset, you know, the income that it produces, its long run growth, those sorts of things really matter ultimately to the investment decision that you make. That's all been put to one side, and all that's motivating people to own assets is the fear of missing out. And when the when the fear of missing out replaces the fundamentals, you know you're on borrowed time, and I'd say we're on borrowed time at the moment.
I would tend to agree.
Thanks, Julie.
Thank you, Julie.
Good on you. Bye-bye. Brian wants to talk about interest rates. Yes, Brian?
Yep. Good evening.
G'day, Brian.
I've got a bit of a theory, and it's I'm on my own in this. The best thing the Reserve Bank could do is put interest rates up and stop this bubble before it takes everybody down with it. When they have low interest rates, people want to borrow money. We bring money in from overseas via the banks to lend it out for all these mortgages. What the country needs is money coming into the country, not flowing out. Yep. And we're just encouraging really bad investment and an economy that's just unsustainable.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've got a thought on that I can share with you in a second. Go ahead.
Yeah, the whole economy is built on just building more and more houses, and it's all Melbourne meets Sydney somewhere, and there's nothing left, and there's no more houses to build.
Yeah,
and we've got no industry.
So I agree with you 100%. I have a fundamental view, and I've shared this with various front bench politicians. I have a fundamental view that the problem that we have is the current account deficit. So that's the difference between what we earn on our exports compared to what we pay for our imports. Now, at the moment, we've got to export 5 or 6 or 7 tons of iron ore to afford one iPhone, right? Now, we don't sell it. We don't get enough from our raw materials that we export to pay for all of our imports. So we're spending far too much on our imports, and we can't afford it from the revenue from our exports. Consequently, we have to import money, which is what you alluded to. We have to import capital. And the way we do that is either via borrowing or by selling our assets. So we're selling our businesses, we're selling our farms, we're selling agricultural land to foreign investors. We're doing all these things, and you often hear the Liberal Party say, and look, I'll put my hand up and say I voted for the Libs, but we often hear them saying foreign investment is necessary in Australia. Yes, it is necessary in Australia, and the reason why it's necessary is because we've got to pay for our profligacy. We've spent too much on our imports, and we've got to replace the money somehow.
Well, we've always been capital poor, though, haven't we?
Yeah, indeed. So here's the thing. Here's the thing. How do we change that? How do we actually change it? We change it by adding value to our exports. Now, where we send out raw meat, we send out live cattle, we send out, you know, timber, and it becomes pulp, and then we import the paper. We don't do a lot of manufacturing in Australia. So I don't think manufacturing is the solution, because it's quite expensive to do in Australia. But what we need to do is we need to encourage the economy, the market system. We need to work out, we need to offer the capitalist model the opportunity to work out what we're good at exporting. So I've said this before to you, Phil. I think what we need is we need a tax holiday for genuine startup businesses that can export something. So, by that I don't mean, you know, Woolies, Neutral Bay, or, you know, that's not a startup business.
What tax holidays is, they're just a straight wealth transfer from one sector of the economy to another. Well, that's all they are.
But if I'm starting a business, because Singapore has it, Israel has it, the UK has it, and the United States has it. And what they've been able to do is they've been able to encourage startup businesses and startup culture and successful export businesses that the government then can identify and say, do you know what? That's working. We're going to support that. That's what we're going to do. We're going to let the market identify what it's good at exporting, and then the government can come in and support that and encourage it with incentives of other types. If we don't do that, then what actually happens is we end up continuing to do what we're doing, which is basically selling our assets or offering IOUs.
In all fairness, we have been down this road before. I mean, we've at various times had 150% R&D write-offs. We've had R&D write-offs of lesser value than that. We've tried similar incentives in the film industry and other industries as well.
There are already too specific
big rebates in the agricultural community for diesel fuel. I mean,
I get all of that. But what we need is a very simple thing. We need to actually say, do you know what, Phil? If you want to go out and start a business and employ people and see if it works, I'll tell you what, on your first $200,000 profit for the first 3 years, there's no tax to pay. Mm-hmm. Now, you might say that's a transfer of wealth, but hang on a sec. If you've started a business that's successful, and it's got to be you're exporting something, you're doing something with the intention of exporting it, mm-hmm. and then we'll reassess it in 3 years' time, or reassess it every year. And I think that would work. And if we combine that, do you know what? If we actually combine that with a trade zone, so for example, let's say we identified Wollongong as a place where you have to go and run that business, then what's going to actually happen is people are going to move to Wollongong. People are going, I'm just picking Wollongong out of thin air, but you know, universities are going to start up there. Young people are going to want to move there and live there and start businesses there. And then suddenly we're going to take pressure off the infrastructure in Sydney as well. And we're going to start nation building again, which I think is potentially a good thing.
The only problem, I think it's unconstitutional, but anyway.
Yeah, maybe.
Brian, good thoughts. Thank you. Thank you for that. Where are we? George, g'day. G'day, George.
G'day, Phil. G'day, Roger. Always
g'day.
Pleasure to listen to your wise words.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with most of what you say. And I think one of the big things we should actually do is try and find a way to actually buy back some of our mining companies who seem to be primarily foreign-owned these days. So most of those super profits are going offshore, which is rather unfortunate in light of the current account deficit. But what I really want to ask you, I'm still worried about the effects of a collapse in the Chinese shadow finance system, sort of the black market finance system, which is so large in China. I've been to one or two conferences where they've talked about this and revealed a lot of stuff that doesn't get into the mainstream headlines or mainstream business papers, and it's rather concerning about how big it is and how unregulated it is. And the real problem I see is that a lot of these Chinese people who are borrowing this or moving money around in the system have never experienced a really big recession, because you know, China, you know, kind of rode through the GFC just because.
Well, and they helped us avoid the GFC as well, the worst of the GFC.
You've talked about this a bit in the past, haven't you?
Yeah, and so that shadow banking, the shadow banking in China is a big issue. What China keeps doing, though, is keeps throwing more money. It keeps expanding credit and stimulating the economy to keep things going. So, for example, basically they've told a lot of banks, we want you to lend 50% more than you lent last year, and don't be selective about who you lend to. And it, again, just it's just helicopter money. In a system that's more open, such as we experience in the Western world, that doesn't last very long, and we're seeing the consequences of that at the moment. In China, though, who knows how long it could continue? There are those who say it's going to end at some time, and what I will say is that each time China has stimulated its economy, the recovery in the economy has been shorter-lived, and it hasn't bounced back as far as it did previously. Mm. So we're seeing that now. They stimulated the economy again in January, and that staved off a bit of a problem that they were facing in terms of declining investment. And I think we're going to see it again. I think you're right.
Thanks, George. Paul, hello.
Oh, hi there. A question for Roger.
Yep.
G'day.
Roger, we have some Seven West Media shares.
Right,
and they are losing money heavily for my wife and I, and they at one stage they were paying a reasonable dividend, but now there's nothing, and the company just seems to be every day the shares go lower and lower.
Let's forget about the stock market for a minute. Let me help you answer your own question. What does the company do?
Well, it's Seven West Media. It owns Channel 7.
Yep.
And it owns the papers there in Western Australia.
And are more people reading papers and watching free-to-air television or less?
Well, it's less, but
yes.
Roger, the company is making 9.5 cents per share.
Yes,
and where's it going to? There's nothing being given back to the shareholders.
Well, there'll be a reason for that. Either they believe they can invest the money better than you can, and so they want it to grow the business, or they need the money just to keep running in the same competitive position that they're in. You know, so they're running to a standstill, if you like. So a business, free-to-air television is tough at the moment in Australia because people have so many other things to entertain them now. They've got smartphones, they've got Instagram feeds, they've got YouTube, there's Netflix, there's so many other things that they can do. They can listen to Phil on the radio and listen to us talking, and they're not, you know, you're not watching Channel 7 right now, you're listening to us. So there's so many reasons why the audience for free-to-air television has been fragmented in Australia. And that's what these businesses are suffering from. So I don't see any near-term recovery there. You know, I think that's structural rather than cyclical.
All the executives of the company are still being paid, quite healthy wages.
You own the business. The shareholders are the owners of the business.
I'm thinking about going along to the meeting. And thumping the table and saying, where is this money going? Because the company, it's Australia's number one TV station.
Well, they're more likely to.
It's got a good cash flow.
They're more likely to listen to you if you round up a few other shareholders to talk to them. You know, the money talks. The more shares that you speak for, the louder your voice is going to be heard.
Oh, thanks, Roger. Okay,
pleasure.
Well, that's all I'll do.
Okay.
Righto, Paul, thank you for that. Bill, g'day. Sorry, where are we? Bill, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Earlier on, you were saying, Roger was saying that now's a good time to buy an apartment, but got to check.
Well, I'm not sure that I said that. I think we're near the bottom for Sydney property. Yeah.
I'm speaking from Perth. However, you talked about buying a quality apartment.
Yes.
How does the average person going into buying an apartment know whether it's a quality apartment or not?
Okay,
it's a very good question.
It's a great question. Yeah. So you know, your baseline is probably don't buy anything that's less than 10 years old because you haven't seen the effects of the build quality work its way through yet. So if it's a poor build quality, you know, some of the problems might not emerge for a decade. So that's the first thing. The second thing is there are Australian builders who have been building apartments for decades and they have an excellent reputation and they didn't change their building techniques in the last 10 years. So they may be okay. But I would, you know, I'm not a professional property investor. I'm in the stock market. I'm a fund manager. And so I would go out and seek some, you know, go and get some advice, go and talk to builders. But I'd be very, very careful of anything that's less than 10 years old.
Isn't there a rule of thumb at the moment, Roger, you wouldn't buy a new one?
Yeah, well, basically that's it, isn't it? If it's less than 10 years old, it's pretty new.
Certainly don't buy a brand new one.
Well, then off the plan's another issue too, right? Yeah, you don't know about the build quality. Yeah. And as we're finding out in Sydney in some of these developments, you've got very, very little recourse.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
thanks,
pleasure.
Bill. Thanks, Bill. But the short answer is, and you know, if you're in an apartment block, I suppose, read the body corporate minutes.
What's happening now is some of the problems with the buildings aren't being minuted because the owners of those properties don't want future buyers to know there were some problems. Now, that's probably illegal.
It's illegal.
I've heard reports that it's happening.
Hmm. Yes. All right. All right, Roger. And there's just a couple of texts too, by the way. Alita, you and I should have a conversation about this one night. Maybe it's the subject of a whole program, actually. Alita from Woodend says, Phil and Roger, is it possible to have a stable economy that does not rely on purchasing stuff? Our environment is full of stuff. How can we live comfortably in a sustainable way?
Well,
it's a profoundly good question.
About a consumer-led economy.
And, yeah, well, a lot of economists have been playing with these ideas now for some time. Is it possible for us to have the kind of market economy that we have that is sustainable, that doesn't rely
on
never-ending growth.
Mm. China has tried that. They're trying to switch to a consumer-led economy because they've been focusing primarily on a fixed asset investment economy where they invest in infrastructure. But eventually you have to stop building stuff too.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Roger, always interesting. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Go so quickly.
Yeah, it does. I know. Roger Montgomery, when you're having fun. Exactly. Roger Montgomery, who's the Chief Investment Officer at the Montgomery Fund.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.